From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember rhythm and blues star Laverne Baker. She died Monday at the age of 67. In the 50s, she had hits like Jim Dandy, Twiddly Dee, and Bumblebee. After living in the Philippines for two decades, she made a comeback in the late 80s. We'll hear an interview from 1991, the year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Also, Sting looks back on his life in music, from his days playing swing jazz in small clubs to his days with the police and his solo career. He's starring in the new movie Gentlemen Don't Eat Poets. Also, guest film critic John Anderson reviews the new comedy romance Love Jones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United States has suspended the evacuation of Americans from Albania. Gunmen shot at military helicopters today that were taking U.S. and Italian citizens away from Tirana, the Albanian capital. The Defense Department says authorities are now reviewing the situation. NPR's Silvio Poggioli says lawlessness reigns in Tiranan streets.
There was one tank going down, up and down the main streets, the center of the town. A lot of firing, a lot of gunfire. We're told this is an attempt to try to assert the government's control of the situation in Tirana. It's totally confusing what's happening here. This is not a city where the people have risen and taken weapons, as has happened in the south. It seems that the people who are firing here are more the followers of President Berisha. It's a very chaotic situation. Nobody's in control. This is a president basically without a state. No one's in charge, and yet President Berisha is still holed up in his office right across the street from where I am.
NPR Silvio Poggioli in Tirana, Albania. Prices at the wholesale level have dropped 2 months in a row for the first time since the fall of 1994. The Labor Department says the producer price index dipped 0.4% in February. Hugh Johnson is an analyst with First Albany Corporation.
Are we starting to see some upward pressure on wholesale prices that's likely to lead the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates? The answer is quite clearly no. At least at the wholesale level, we're not seeing anything that's very troubling yet.
But Johnson says Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan remains troubled by upward pressure on wages. He could urge the Fed's policymakers to raise short-term interest rates. As residents of Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Illinois, and Indiana clean up from the recent flooding, they could be eligible for some assistance they didn't know about. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
It's a deceleration injury. He was coming down some stairs. When you step down, that's when your quadricep functions. And he stumbled, and his quadricep contracted very hard and literally pulled the tendon off the bone.
President Clinton has returned to Washington, D.C. for knee surgery. Mr. Clinton was in Florida when he stumbled early this morning and tore a tendon in his knee. He was supposed to talk to school children at Lighthouse Elementary School in Jupiter, Florida. Instead, he spoke to them by a radio hookup from Air Force One. Mr. Clinton told the children that he was fine and that he was sorry that he missed them. The president says the mishap will not prevent him from keeping most of his normal schedule, including a summit with Russian President Boris Yeltsin later this month. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 52 points at 6,930. Trading is active. The Nasdaq is up more than 8 points at 1,301. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market rallied this morning from yesterday's plunge. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The day's economic news suggests there is less urgency for the Fed to increase interest rates. Wholesale prices unexpectedly fell for the second month in a row during February, even though industrial production rebounded. Investors believe this ideal combination of low inflation and moderate economic growth will continue to produce stable interest rates and steady corporate earnings growth. There is a caveat, though. Today's reading on consumer sentiment was stronger than expected. If that were translated into increased spending, it might concern Fed policymakers. Today's advance is broad-based. The S&P 500 and the Nasdaq Composite are both higher. I'm Doug Krisner.
Union workers at a General Motors truck assembly plant went on strike today in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Workers are dissatisfied with staffing, safety, and other local issues. The factory produces about a quarter of GM's full-size CK pickups, the automaker's best-selling vehicles. This is an assembly plant, not a parts plant, so the walkout will not have an immediate effect on other GM plants in Indiana. A spokesman for GM's truck group would not comment on the issues at hand, but the local union says it has more than 100 demands. At the top of the list, a demand for more plant workers. Apple Computer is expected to announce a new round of job and product cuts today. The company's chairman, Gil Amelio, who joined the company last year, had hoped to see profits by now, but losses have increased instead. The Wall Street Journal reports that the Apple turnaround plan will now rely heavily on cutting Apple's product line. Analysts are not sure that this move will succeed. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we lost Laverne Baker, one of the rhythm and blues stars of the 50s and early 60s. We'll remember her and her music on this archive edition of Fresh Air. With hits in the 50s like Jim Dandy, Bumblebee, and Tweedledee Dee, Laverne Baker was one of Atlantic Records' first big success stories. During most of the 70s and 80s, she lived in the Philippines, where she ran a nightclub in Subic Bay. Her career was revived in 1988 when she performed at a 40th anniversary concert for Atlantic Records in Madison Square Garden. That led her to Broadway, where she appeared in the R&B review Black and Blue, and that led to her return to the recording studio. I spoke with Laverne Baker in 1991, the year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I asked her about another one of her big hits from the 50s. Why don't we listen to Bumblebee?
Oh, wow.
I think, you know, this is kind of a novelty record, but it's a wonderful recording.
Yes, I'm singing it now, and I feel so very, very funny singing that.
Why do you feel funny about it?
Well, because I was, you know, very, very young, and at the time it fitted me, you know. It was good, and I had a big hit with it with the kids. But now I'm much older. I feel funny singing it, you know, but I'll do it. You know, I do it. And I'm surprised that my voice can reach the squeaky part now. I still can do it. So I do it. You know, if someone asks for it, I'll do it.
So do you do it differently?
No, I do it the same. The same. I do all of my recordings identical, the same. Matter of fact, I have hired two backup singers to do the background so that the people will know, you know, what they heard before. It still sounds the same.
Okay, let's listen to Laverne Baker, and this is Bumblebee.
Shut, shut, shut. I'm gonna have to put you shut, down.
Shut, shut.
You've been treating me like a
shut,
clown.
Shut, shut.
You know you've hurt me once before.
Shut, shut.
You'll never hurt me anymore.
Shut, shut.
Evil bumblebee.
Shut, shut.
I gave you love as sweet as honey.
Shut, shut.
My life, my soul, and all my
shut,
money.
Shut, shut.
You didn't seem to realize
shut, shut.
You had a home in paradise.
Shut, shut. Shooey, you hurt me like a bee.
A bumblebee, an evil bumblebee. One kiss before you go. Don't ever come back no more. Now, baby, there's no need of crying.
Shut, shut.
I'm sick and tired.
So my guest Laverne Baker is recorded in 1960. Now, Laverne Baker, you were born in Chicago, and you started performing in your teens.
Yes.
And when you started performing in clubs around Chicago, you were known as Little Miss Sharecropper. Who gave you that name?
Regretfully, yes. Some guy. Well, it was a long story. It's like at the big club, Delisa, which was the place during those early 40s, 50s in Chicago. And they had a singer there named Little Miss Cornshuck. And she was a great singer. And she used to come out with a little, like, Bo Peep outfit on, with a little basket, mm-hmm. ribbons in her hair. And she was, quite famous. Her name was the Talk of Chicago. And she got on the wrong path, you know, and wasn't able to perform. So then they were looking for someone to take her place. So I met this guy at another one of our big clubs. I had went to see the show, and I did a guest number. And he said, you know, they're looking for a good singer at Club Delisa. So I was a little nervous to go to the breakfast dance because I didn't have no business out that, you know, all night long at that during those years, you know, because the breakfast dance started at 6 o'clock in the morning. But I slipped and went anyway, and I got the job. And the next thing I knew, they had put these little costumes and ribbons and baskets in my hand, and they called me Little Miss Sharecropper because they couldn't use Corn Shuck. You know, and Sharecropper was related to that. But about 2 years after I left, I hurried up and got rid of it. So,
did you protest when they wanted to outfit you that way? And
no, I
that?
Didn't. You know, you got to get your foot in the door before you can say anything in regards to what you do. You know, I wasn't strong. I just wanted to get started, and I didn't care how, you know, as long as it was legit, you know. So they wanted me to sing. And hey, I enjoyed it for a while, you know. But then as I started to mature, you know, and I saw other singers, you know, looking so beautiful on stage, I didn't like it anymore.
Now, I want to read you a review from Variety. And this is from 1954, the year that you signed with Atlantic.
Wow.
And this is a review of you at the Apollo.
Oh, I see.
And the reviewer wrote, "She's a strong-voiced looker who embellishes her singing with movement and suggestiveness worthy of any grind artist. And while this goes well at the Apollo, she'll have to hold back in other situations." weird review, but I was wondering, you know, what were you doing in your act then, and did you have to change what you were doing
yes,
in terms of emotions?
Yes. Yes. As you mature, you know, like for one-nighters and the Apollo, that was great, you know?
What were you doing?
I have a thing I do. I turn around and my behind moves, you know, and stuff like that. You know, I still can do it. You know, it's all muscle control type thing, you know. But the audience go crazy when you do this, you know, and the young audiences back then in rock and roll. And at that time, I was not playing sophisticated and big nightclubs. I was doing strictly one-nighters and theaters. So I had to stick to it. But, you know, as I got a little older, I wanted to change, and I did change. And I made it. I went to Basin Street East with Louis Armstrong more than one time, you know. And I played Vegas. And these are rooms and things that I could not get when I was in rock and roll. So I had to change my act, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were one of the first black singers to cross over to a white teenage audience.
Yes.
In the 1950s. Was there a conscious attempt at Atlantic Records to give you a certain kind of material or to change your stage act in any way to help you cross over?
No, the music, Atlantic always picked my music, Ahmed and Jerry at the time. They always picked, you know, the songs that they wanted me to sing or they thought that would be best for me. And I never argued at that particular time. I'll fight now, but I didn't argue then. And because they knew what they wanted, you know. But coincidentally, the things that they gave me, I enjoyed doing at that time. So I gave my best at it, you know. And sometimes they would come in the studio and play different things and holler in the background, you know, to make it better, you know, sound like more people.
Did holler in the background on the record?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
record did they do that on?
Quite a few. They'd sing with at that time we had a group called, the backup group called the Q's. And a lot of things he'd come in and he'd sing with them to show them what he wanted, you see. And this is the way we worked back then, you know. We had a small room and it was... like they were on one side and we were on the other, and, you know, and we made millions of hits up there in that little hole that we were in.
Now, I want to play Tweedledee, but, you know, the voices that come in at the beginning, They're kind of square-sounding voices, don't you think?
Yes, these are the cues. And one of the cues is the one that wrote Tweety D, Mr. Winfield Scott. He's the one that wrote it. And that is the longest recording session I've ever had in my life.
What made it so long?
We did 52 takes.
Whoa, you're kidding.
No, I kid you not.
How come? What went
wrong? Well, he wasn't satisfied. It was something missing. And during the break, we know they always give us a little break for tea or whatever, the rest of our voices, you know. And I did, I was kidding with it, and I said, hump, be hump, bump, bump, like that. And Ahmed said, that's it, that's it. That we, that's how that got in there. You know, it was just something missing that he wasn't. And he's like that now, you know. He's like that now. Everybody say he's still the same. If he's in a date and he's not comfortable, you know, he knows what he like, you know. And if he don't hear it, he'll keep pushing, you know. So that's that with the Tweety D session. It was very, very long.
Well, why don't we listen to Tweedly D? And this is my guest, Laverne Baker.
Tweedly, 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 Tweedly D. I'm as happy as can be. Jiminy Cricket, Jiminy Jack, you make my heart go clickety-clack.
This Laverne Baker is recorded in 1955, a song that went up to number 14 on the charts. Big hit for you. Now, how did you feel when you were given the song? Did you like the song?
Yes and no.
What was the yes and what was the no?
Well, because, you know, I told you we did so many takes. And it's it just didn't make any sense to me, okay? You know, and
but the lyric or the
yeah, the lyric. The music was okay. We had to find the music to really fit it, you know. So I came up with a suggestion of Brazil. If you notice, it's
at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, dun 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 dun. So you know, and that's why I was so upset when Georgia Gibbs covered my record, because we worked very hard to stay away from the main track of Brazil, just a little taste of it, you know. And then she recorded my song word for word. I was very upset with this because she used my arrangement. Use your own arrangement, you know. That was the only kick, because once the song is PD. Public domain, anybody can sing it, you know. I was really upset with the arrangement because we worked very hard on that.
Georgia Gibbs' cover of your record went up to number 2 on the charts.
I know. It was so many people they thought they had the original and they didn't. They had hers.
Now, she was a white singer.
Yes.
Recording your hit.
Yeah.
Were there stations that would play the white singer's version of it that wouldn't play yours?
Oh, yeah. And there were some of them that played hers, and after they found out she wasn't the original, they wouldn't play it anymore. You know, this happened in the whole state of Illinois and Michigan.
Did you play a lot of the rock and roll shows that were put together by Alan Freed and
Yes,
Murray
I
McKay?
Did. Yeah.
What was it like to perform with those? Who were some of the people who shared the bill with you? And
so many.
What was it? Yeah.
Oh, so many. I wish I had known you were going to ask me that. Let's see. The last show I did with Free, I think, was at the Brooklyn Paramount. It was Chuck Berry, and I got my eyes closed trying to remember this. It was Chuck Berry, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, the Everly Brothers, Paul Anka, Screaming Jay Hawkins, Bill Doggett. Oh, quite a few. I can't remember them all.
What a show.
Yeah, he used to carry, we had 2 busloads full to capacity and maybe 4 cars all the time.
We're featuring a 1991 interview with Laverne Baker. She died Monday at the age of 67. We'll get back to the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
woke up this morning, my baby was gone.
Laverne Baker is my guest. In the 1950s, you recorded an entire album of Bessie Smith songs.
Oh, I loved it. Now, that's a recording date I enjoyed. I really did enjoy it. I loved the songs. And after I listened to Bessie Smith, and even now that I'm older, and when I do her numbers, I sound more like her, you know. I was told that by the bass player and some of the guys who actually worked with Bessie Smith that was still living, Atlantic got some of the original guys that played with her. You know, and they told me, said, man, you really sound like Bessie, you know. I just have one of those big growling voices, I guess, you know. And it's worse now that I'm older.
Well, it's a great album, and it was reissued recently on compact disc.
Yeah.
So let's play something off of it. This is the opening track, and this is Pigfoot.
Oh.
Sounds really terrific. Was Bessie Smith a big influence on you?
No. Let's say singers from that era did, you know. And then my mom and my grandmom, they were all gospel singers in church. So naturally I grew up in church, you know, that's where most of us come from, you know.
What was it like for you in the 60s when you stopped having hit records and when the kind of records making the pop charts were changing?
Well, I tell you what, I was a smart cookie. I left before it stopped. I realized it was getting slow, and I guess the good Lord was with me. My Asian tour came in right in the middle of that. And I said, well, let me get this, because in Asia, and you play in the military bases, and they know you, you know, and at that time, you know, it was great, and I had a good show put together. So I really forgot all about it, you know.
This is what, a USO tour?
No, I don't do USO. I go over independently and by myself. Uh-huh. You know, and I travel from, my tour went from Tokyo to Vietnam and back again to Guam.
So you're still living in the Philippines?
Yes, I still maintain my kids are there. But I'm going to go and close out my house and file my petition to get my baby out, because my baby is half-half. She's half Filipino and half American. So I have to go through quite a bit to get her papers ready to get her out of the Philippines. And then I will resign my post, because I still carry my contract and ID cards for the base. And then my mother wants me to come home, so I think I'll come home for whatever time God has for me left. I will spend it here in America.
Will you be recording again soon?
I pray so. Well, I just had a new release, which I'm grateful was released last Wednesday, a CD of all my, some of my old hits, released by Warner Atlantic, you know, they're together. And it's got Tweely D, I Cried a Tear, and so forth and so on. It's a reissue, you know, but it's on CD.
Great.
Uh-huh. But we're going to do some more, and I'm hoping to do some more recording. I have several offers. But I'm still holding out because I want to stay with Atlantic if I can. They're lucky for me, you know?
Yeah.
They have been very great for me, you know. So, but, you know, I don't mind. I want to try something of the new stuff, you know. If I can't make it, then I can't make it. But I would like to try. I'm the type, I'll try it, you know. I'm not a giver up. I fight, you know. And I want to make a rap record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I want to rap with something in my groove, you know, just to fight back with the youngsters.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Laverne Baker, recorded in 1991. She died Monday of heart complications at the age of 67. Let's listen to a song from her final album, Woke Up This Morning, recorded in 1992 on the DRG label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
To spend one night with you in our old rendezvous and reminisce with you, that's my desire. To meet where gypsies play down in that dim cafe, we'll dance until the break of day. That's my desire. We'll sip a little glass of wine. I'll gaze into your eyes divine. I want to feel the touch of your lips pressing on you love. Oh,
Coming up from the archives, an interview with Sting. He's starring in the new film Gentlemen Don't Eat Poets. Also, guest film critic John Anderson reviews Love Jones, a contemporary urban romance.
There's a little black spot on the sun today. It's the same old thing as yesterday. There's a black hat caught in a high tree top. There's a flagpole rack and the wind won't stop. I have stood here before inside the pouring rain with the world turning circles running round my brain. I guess I'm always hoping that you'll end this rain, but it's my destiny to be the king of pain. There's a little black spot.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sting is starring in the new movie Gentlemen Don't Eat Poets, based on a story by Patrick McGraw. Sting's international tour ended last week, and tomorrow night he hosts Saturday Night Live. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded with him last year after the release of his CD Mercury Falling. We talked about life before and after he became known as Sting. He grew up, Gordon Sumner, in Newcastle, England. In the late 70s, he was the lead vocalist and bass player of the British rock band The Police. Their hits included Roxanne and Every Breath You Take. Sting went on to a very successful solo career. He's also acted in the films Quadrophenia, Brimstone and Trickle, Stormy Monday, and The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen. And he played McHeath in a Broadway production of Threepenny Opera. Let's start with a song from Mercury Falling. This is I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying.
7 weeks have passed now since she left me. She shows her face to ask me how I am. She says the kids are fine, that they miss me. Maybe I could come and babysit sometime. She says, are you okay? I was worried about you. Can you forgive me? I hope that you'll be happy. I say, I'm so happy that I can't stop crying. I'm so happy I'm laughing through my tears.
Sting, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us about the song we just heard, I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying, about how you wrote the lyric and the music for this one.
I actually wrote it as a different kind of song. It's kind of a rock song, really. And then I looked again at the lyrics and I realized, you know, it's about divorce and separation and it's a country song. So I changed the arrangement and I put two in the bar on the bass and I got a pedal steel player in and... I think there's a certain amount of irony about it being a country song, and yet it works. You know, I think the song is quite cynical in the beginning. He says, I'm so happy I can't stop crying, and he doesn't mean it. But I think by the end of the song, he's made some kind of journey of acceptance of the situation, or some kind of ability to face that situation, the courage to face the situation, and he actually means it by the end. So there's a journey being made, and... I like that song, actually.
I'd like to talk with you about your life and go back to your early days as a child. I know you grew up in Newcastle, England, an industrial town?
It's a seaport and various heavy industries. There's a coal field there. And It was an interesting town, though. It wasn't uninteresting. It certainly was. It was a Roman town. It was a medieval town. It was an Industrial Revolution town.
Was there much of much live music or any arts community there?
A huge music group there, mainly folk music and jazz. And every pub on every street corner has some kind of music going on in there. And that was the first sort of arena where I learned to play.
And how did you start singing?
How did I start singing? I always had a voice, actually. I would sing very sweetly in the choir at school. But when asked to sing on my own, it simply wasn't macho to be able to sing, so I would feign the voice of a crow, as all my peers did. But actually, when everybody was singing, I would have this angelic sort of voice. And I was aware that I could sing. I knew that I could sing. It was only when I began to play the guitar about the age of 8 or 9, and I think I began to sing about the age of 10.
Now, you went to Catholic school?
I did.
Did you ever go through a period of wanting to be a priest?
I did. I toyed with that idea, but rather perversely, I thought it was a good way of getting women.
Being a priest?
Yeah.
Why would you say that's a little perverse?
I think it is.
Why would you think that that would be a good way of getting women? Well, a drummer, I can understand. A priest, I
don't get
it.
I just thought, you know, priests were always surrounded by women. Weren't the priests in your neighborhood surrounded by women? I thought you look kind of attractive in your cassock, you know, and all those costumes. I think the theatricality of the whole thing appealed to me. But the celibacy put me off.
Right, yeah. Right. So when did you wise up?
I wised up pretty quickly. I mean, I toyed with the idea, but it was only toying. A lot of my friends became monks, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they still?
I think so, yeah.
Now, how did you react to the discipline of Catholic school?
It was a fairly disciplined school. I was in a school with almost 3,000 boys. So to keep order, I think it was a fairly brutal regime. You weren't allowed to step out of line without being hit very hard. But I rebelled a little bit. I was caned a lot. We were caned with a big stick.
On your knuckles or your behind?
No, on the behind. And, you know, I look back on it now. I don't mind it. I wouldn't have my children go through that. But I don't think it did me any harm, to be honest with you.
Did you ever cry when you were caned?
You don't cry from pain. You cry from rage. After the third or fourth one, it's rage because it hurts.
That's kind of like crying because of pain, isn't it?
No, it's different.
It's different.
Crying from pain is different. Crying from rage is worse, actually.
So was it hard to sit after a caning?
You didn't want to sit after a caning, no.
Now, what was your school uniform like?
It was kind of maroon, a maroon jacket, gray trousers, gray shirt, a maroon tie, usually raggy, you know, raggy trousers and elbows that were worn.
How did you feel about having to wear a uniform?
It kind of marked you out from the rest of the kids you'd been brought up with, working class kids that, you know, you would play with in the street. When at the age of 11, you're whisked off to this school. I have to wear a uniform. It kind of separated you.
In a good way or a bad way?
No, a bad way.
Well, did it mean that you were probably wimpier or something?
No, it meant I was ostracized, really. That we were sort of told that we were the cream. You know, we were the top 10% of intelligence in the country. And I don't think it was true. But that kind of separated us from other people. I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew the value of school. I knew that I wanted to do as well as I could academically because that was a route out, a route away from where I was. I wasn't very happy where I was.
What didn't you like about where you were?
It seemed to be a sort of monochrome world. You know, it was kind of grey. I used to go to the movies with my brother on a Saturday and we'd see this technicolor world of Hollywood, you know, and I think, why isn't life like that here? So I wanted to escape to a technicolor world.
We're listening to an interview with Sting recorded last year. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Well, let's get back to the story of Sting, the early years. So we had established that you went to Catholic school. And when, I guess it was after college, you taught poetry in a convent school for a while. Do I have that right?
I taught poetry. I taught soccer. I taught music. I qualified as an English teacher.
Uh-huh.
And I taught in school for about 2 years. I trained for 3 years and taught for two. I enjoyed teaching, actually. I enjoyed the hurly-burly of the classroom. I enjoyed standing up in front of a classroom and imparting things. I'm not sure that I taught anybody anything. I think that what happens in a classroom is learning, you know. I think some learning went on. When I enjoyed a subject, I could express enthusiasm for it, and therefore hopefully the kids got that enthusiasm in an infectious kind of way. But when I wasn't interested, I don't think I could teach anything.
So was this a convent school?
It was. It was run by nuns. I was the only man on the staff.
Oh, this is perfect. This is like your fantasy come true almost.
Well, not quite. Not quite, no.
No. Oh, well, actually, it must be pretty strange to be a young man surrounded by women in the most non-sexual place that you could imagine.
Well, I got away with murder, actually. I was a musician at the time, and I was working very late at night in bands and sometimes having to go away for gigs. And so they just let me get away with it. You know, I was just said, look, I've got a gig tonight. Can I have the afternoon off? Or I got in late last night. Can I have the morning off?
So what was the band that you were moonlighting in?
I was in a lot of bands. I used to play in traditional jazz groups, actually, like Dixieland jazz groups.
And you played bass?
I played the bass, mainly with much older people than myself. And I learned jazz standards that way. I learned to read music that way. It was a strange education for a rock musician. I mean, most rock musicians learn Led Zeppelin songs, and I was learning 12th Street Rag.
So you were playing an upright bass?
I was playing an upright bass. But I was having a great time. I loved it. It didn't seem to be the route to rock stardom, though.
Is that what you wanted?
No. I wanted to be a muser. I wanted to be a musician. And this seemed to be the right way to go. And then I was in a big band. I played Count Basie arrangements, Neil Hefti arrangements, Duke Ellington arrangements. And I don't know, I think if I have a broad musical outlook now, it's because of the way I was educated musically, and that it wasn't just three chords in a garage, it was something else. Then I worked in theatres in the pit for musicals. I backed comedians, I backed striptease artists, I've just about done every musical job. I even played on a cruise ship.
So did you learn how to transpose and play in any key, depending on who you were backing?
Yeah, you'd learn how to busk. I mean, it's a phrase in England, you busk. They start a tune, and then they change the key at will, you know, and if they raise one finger, it's in the key of G. If they raise two, it's in the key of D. If they raise three fingers, it's in the key of A. If they put one finger down, it's in the key of F, and two fingers down is the key of B flat. I mean, it you learn all these codes, and you learn all the standards. I once backed Tiny Tim, actually.
Really?
And he could sing every standard, hundreds and hundreds of standards, one after the other, and that was a hell of a job.
So, now, what was the bridge between the work that you were doing and a rock and roll band?
I found a couple of people who were in this world with me, who were my age, and who had interest in playing jazz or rock and roll. And we formed a group in my hometown, and we used to play our own music in a pub. And we ended up with a residency. The band was called Last Exit. And I was the singer and the bass player, and we had a group that was very similar to the group I have at the moment, which is a four-piece group with drums, keyboards, bass, and guitar.
So how did you get an audition for The Police when the band was forming?
I was playing with this band called Last Exit at a local college, and a rock journalist that I knew who was local, he used to do local reviews of big bands, I just reviewed a band called Curved Air, and the drummer of Curved Air was Stuart Copeland. And after the gig, he said, why don't you come to this college and see this band Last Exit, because the singer is very interesting. He was talking about me. And I met Stuart afterwards, and, you know, we exchanged telephone numbers, and he said, if you're ever in London, call me. So you know, about 3 months later, I decided that I was going to go to London and seek my fortune. Stuart's was the only telephone number I had. I called him up. He was living in a squat in Mayfair. You know what a squat is?
It's basically a place you move into that's like an abandoned...
Yeah, and you don't pay any rent. Anyway, I moved in there. We started this band. He called it The Police. It was his group. He'd written these songs, and it was the time of sort of punk, you know, the Sex Pistols and Johnny Rotten and all that. Mm-hmm. And we started the play in this old loft and got a few gigs, and I really didn't think it was going to happen. I didn't think the music was serious enough, but I stuck with it. And we ended up with a guitarist called Andy Summers, who was that was the final group that ended up as The Police. And we made a record called Roxanne. The record company heard it. They liked it. They signed it. It was a moderate hit. And then we came to America. And we came without a record company, actually. We came just with our airfares and enough money to hire a bus. A little station wagon, actually. And we turned up at little gigs in places like Poughkeepsie and Syracuse, and three or four people would come to these gigs. And we built it up that way, slowly.
Roxanne really has a reggae influence. Had you been listening to a lot of reggae yourself?
I would contest that. A lot of people say it's reggae. It's not. It's a tango if you listen to it.
You think so?
It's a tango. I mean, I was
listening to it again this morning and thinking, really reggae.
I was thinking that, I mean, I was very fond of Bob Marley at the time, so I was singing like Bob Marley, but the music actually is a tango.
Mm-hmm.
It's not reggae.
When you say you're singing like Bob Marley, were you trying to get some of his inflections also?
Yeah, absolutely. So. I was very influenced by Bob, and that's a clear influence. But the music itself isn't reggae.
Well, why don't we hear some of Roxanne, your first hit?
You'll hear it's a tango.
Okay. Listen closely. Now, Roxanne was actually banned by the BBC, wasn't it? Because the lyrics were about prostitution?
Oh, I think they were looking for an excuse not to play it. I mean,
why would they need an excuse not to play it? I mean, why would they not want to play it?
Because so many records come out, they're dying for an excuse to say, well, we can't even consider this one. But we made a big thing out of that. They banned us, you know. I don't think it was because of the subject matter. It's quite benign, really.
Now, this was a period when The Police were getting started, when punk music, punk rock was also taking off. Did you want to be a part of that, or did you feel aesthetically distant from it?
Well, you know, I was a musician, I felt. You know, I paid my dues as a musician. And I felt punk was about people who just picked up guitars that month and made records. And the energy was something that I appreciated. Understood, and their anger was something that I really associated with, because I felt I'd been shut out of the music industry too. So I definitely felt a part of that. Well, the musical thing was not really my cup of tea, but I think it was a flag of convenience that we flew. I mean, I looked like I was part of the scene, even though I was a real musician, and so I just, you know, was expedient use of a fashion, if you like.
Now, how did it feel, too, to have a much kind of more pure, sweet voice in the era of punk when people were actually shouting songs a lot, too?
Yeah, but they're only shouting because they couldn't sing. You know, I can do that as well. I think it's a choice that I make, actually.
What surprised you most about rock and roll success?
That success and happiness weren't the same thing. If anything, they seem to be the opposite. I think some of the most successful periods in my life were the most unhappy. That was a good lesson to learn. It's a lesson that I take very seriously now. Success for me is to be happy and sane, not necessarily have millions of records sold or millions of Grammy nominations or whatever. That's not particularly wonderful. It's nice, but it's not happiness.
Remember you said as a kid you went to the movies and you wished you could live in that kind of Technicolor world. Mm-hmm. Did you ever end up feeling like you inhabited that kind of Technicolor world?
I don't remember.
Right. Okay. Too distracted by...
I was distracted. I mean, I'm glad I was quite old. I was 25 or 26 when all of this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I'd been any younger, I'd probably been dead. But I managed to survive it, and I'm here today to tell the tale. But it was pretty wild. I mean, it was pretty meteoric. I mean, it was just everything is thrown at you, and nothing is encouraging you to grow up or be responsible.
It always seems like such a dangerous formula for somebody who's young.
I think it is. And, you know, you can be 19 and be on top of the world, and then the next year you're at the bottom of the heap, and that's an impossible tragedy. You can't really recover from that.
You've had a parallel acting career, which began, I think, with Quadrophenia. Was that your first film?
That was the second film I made, but again, I fell into films by accident. I had no ambition to be an actor. I never trained as an actor. I was never even in a school play. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right haircut.
Of the films of yours that I've seen, my favorite performance is in Stormy Monday. Which Mike Figgis directed, who also directed Leaving Las Vegas. And you're a kind of corrupt, pretty mean club owner.
Oh, I thought I was rather nice, actually. Yeah, right. Well, that was set in Newcastle, which is the hometown
That's where you grew up.
Of both Mike Figgis and myself. And
did that have anything to do with you meeting?
Oh, absolutely. He wanted someone who knew that scene. That club scene was very similar to my musical background. I used to play in clubs like that. And so he knew that and cast me because of that. And I actually played my brother in that. My brother owns a club in Newcastle.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of music does he have?
He has, you know, jazz and rock and roll and folk music.
Gee, does he impose on you to... to come and play?
No, he doesn't. But he recognized himself in the movie. Which is quite funny.
That was Sting, recorded last year. He's starring in the new movie Gentlemen Don't Eat Poets, and tomorrow night he hosts Saturday Night Live. Coming up, a review of the new movie Love Jones. This is Fresh Air. Love Jones is a modern romantic comedy of manners and missed opportunities. It was first shown at this year's Sundance Film Festival and won the Audience Award for Best Dramatic Feature. Like Waiting to Exhale before it, Love Jones puts a new face on film romance. Guest film critic John Anderson has a review.
The Nouvelle Beatniks of Theodore Witcher's Love Jones are smart. They're attractive. They're exceedingly hip. They spend their evenings at poetry jams and cocktail parties, quoting George Bernard Shaw and debating the erotic implications of a female god. They can discern the Gordon Parks influence in a big city still life and distinguish between takes of a Charlie Parker solo. They drink white wine. They want true love. They can derail a romance with the nonchalance of hailing a taxicab. That they're all African Americans is both incidental and essential to Love Jones. While its story certainly isn't new, its complexion is. And the film draws the almost presumptuous conclusion that black people can populate a modern urban romance that isn't anatomically obsessed, abusively misogynistic, or riddled with gunfire. At a time when Hollywood's own Jones has been the compulsive reduction of blacks to either criminals or victims, pushers or addicts, sidekicks or sideshows, Love Jones has become remarkable simply by doing the obvious. At the same time, the film is more than just a novelty. We get caught up in the self-inflicted misery of its lovesick characters, who are portrayed by performers with some eclectic work behind them. Poet-novelist Darius Lovefall is played by Larence Tate, who is the homicidal O-Dog of Menace to Society and the fragile man-child of the inkwell and the shattered Vietnam vet of dead presidents. As Nina, the object of Darius' star-crossed attraction, we have Nia Long of Boys in the Hood, Made in America, The Recent Friday, and NBC's Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Darius and Nina collide at the Sanctuary, a club where poetry, jazz, and sexual tension make up their own kind of cocktail. It's a place where the vagaries of love are examined and debated, and where Darius can explain his own theories of romance and what happens to it.
Romance is about the possibility of the thing. You see, it's about the time between when you first meet some fine-ass woman and when you first make love to her. Or when you first ask a woman to marry you and when she says, I do. When people who've been together for a long time say that the romance is gone, what they're really saying is they've exhausted the possibility.
Darius sees nothing but possibilities in Nina, but when she strikes up a conversation, he spills her drink. In an attempt to recover, he spontaneously titles a poem Blues for Nina and delivers an erotic and embarrassingly graphic mating call from the Sanctuary stage. Nina fails to respond the way he intended, and she tells Darius there are subjects for poetry other than sex. Like what, he asks. She takes his pen, writes the word love on his hand, and seals his fate. Love Jones progresses along the well-worn track of boy meets girl, loses girl, reconciles, loses, and possibly reunites with girl, the problems all stemming largely from ego and a 90s-style aversion to emotional commitment. Writer and director Theodore Witcher shows a lot of insight into the chemistry of romance and how the potential lovers are willfully blind to what the audience sees so clearly, that these two are meant for each other. There's a terrific moment when Darius lets his guard down for the briefest instant, telling his friend Savon, who's played by Isaiah Washington, that he thinks Nina's the one, as in one true love, all capital letters and heavy breathing. Then, as he tries to backtrack and kid his way out of this very unmacho admission, Savon just smiles, knowing full well that his friend has been landed like a big fat fish. Like the affair it chronicles, Love Jones has its structural imperfections. Larence Tate, who was so powerful in Menace to Society, makes Darius a little too cool and callow for the sophisticated Nina, who Long plays with enormous charm. Some of their misconnections seem to owe more to screenwriting than destiny. And where do the characters get the money for their expansive Chicago apartments? I haven't the foggiest idea. But Witcher directs with a great deal of style and a disarming amount of candor. Sometimes, Darius says, a man just wants to be held. Occasionally, a movie has the nerve to admit it.
John Anderson is a film critic for Newsday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Prudick, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.